Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi, how are you all? I hope you've all had a great week. I haven't. England went out of the World Cup yesterday and I am gutted. So thank you for all the tweets I got yesterday laughing at me. But congratulations to France. Congratulations to Croatia. It should be a cracking final. It's been an amazing World Cup. But no, I won't be tweeting about this or talking about this much more, which I know some of you will be glad about. And we're also still stuck in this bear market. God, it never seems to end, does it? My first experience of one, learning from it. But I do have something to distract you this week. Actually, this is a cracking interview. This is with Toby Simpson from Fetch.ai. And I do get approached a few times a week with people offering me guests. And most of the time, I'm not really interested and I reject them. But this one, I was happy to do. I was happy to meet with Toby. I find the area of artificial intelligence really interesting. I grew up on Terminator 2 with Skynet taking over the world, and I've seen the warnings from Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and that this should be regulated and we need to be very careful with it. So it was very interesting to meet Toby, somebody who knows a lot about this, and to put some questions to him. We do talk about Fetch, do talk about the project, the world which they've created for autonomous agents to be able to exchange value, but we also have a good half an hour at the end talking about wider issues and concerns about AI, and it's absolutely fascinating, especially as Toby comes from probably a much more positive angle than most of the films we will have seen have foreseen how AI will take over the world. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this as much as I enjoyed recording it. In other news, I'll be recording the first interview for my new podcast this weekend, which is not going to be about crypto and Bitcoin. It's going to be about wider stories and interesting people. I'm going to record 3 or 4 before I have it released. And if you've got any suggestions for interesting guests, please do get in touch. I don't need crypto people, just interesting stories. So yeah, feel free to get in touch and email me about that. And once it's ready, I'll share it with you. And hopefully some of you will find it interesting and want to support this new show. Also, please support the show. Please leave me a review on iTunes. It really does help. You can follow me on social media. I'm at What Bitcoin Did on Twitter, Medium, Steemit, Instagram. So you find me on all those places. Feel free to check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com. And you can sign up to my newsletter. And also, please do share this out with your friends and family. It really does help with the reach of the show. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the interview now. As I said, I hope you enjoy this as much as I do. I think it's a really fascinating interview. And if you do have any questions or you do want to check out Fetch, I will share all their details in the show notes. But do feel free to email me and I will most likely get back to you. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And yeah, let me know what you think. Good morning, Toby.
Good morning.
This is very nice to meet you here, because usually I have to travel a long way and I've had a 40-minute journey this morning, which is very nice. So nice to meet you here in Cambridge. Can you just tell me your name, your background, and let everyone know who you are and what you do here at Fetch?
So I'm Toby Simpson. I am co-founder and CTO at Fetch, and I originally come from a computer games background.
And how did Fetch come to be?
Well, Fetch is something that one way or the other we've been talking about, myself and the other co-founders, for, probably about the last decade. As part of the work I was doing in the past, trying to build, I wanted to build the Matrix for my living room, trying to figure out just how to make a virtual world of such magnitude that you could put all this stuff in it. And actually, we were talking about whether or not, if you could build one really big enough, then maybe you could put representatives of everything in it, a representative of data, people, things, hardware, and you might actually end up with something that was a new way in which value could be exchanged. But we couldn't figure out how to get the scale, because with conventional virtual world techniques, you don't trust the clients, but you do trust the servers, and there's a scaling point there. But actually, along comes decentralized ledger technology, and we suddenly thought, now we don't have to worry about this, because now we can distribute the load of creating this world across every single computer on the network. And that suddenly freed us up to think about putting billions, if not tens or hundreds of billions, of digital entities in this kind of space.
That's quite interesting, though, because one of the big problems across the blockchain space is scaling. A lot of people talk about scaling issues, and perhaps people are adding blockchains to projects when they don't need it. But for you, it's actually a solution.
Yes, that's exactly right. We didn't start thinking about this problem as a blockchain or a decentralized ledger problem. This was something where that was one of the key parts that allowed us to get the scalability that we wanted. Because ultimately, when you've got these digital representatives of all this stuff, not only are you going to need a very large number of them, but you're going to need a very, very large world for them to live in. And this just allowed us to create that world in a decentralized fashion where you never quite know who you can and who you can't trust.
So I think a good starting point would be getting into the nuts and bolts of Fetch. Let's understand exactly what it is. I've been on the website. I've read parts of your white paper. It's quite complicated. But there's a number of components within it in terms of marketplaces and your open economic framework. So in layman's terms, can you try and explain to us what Fetch is and what it does and what its application will be in the real world?
I like to think of Fetch as the ultimate dating agency for value providers. Fetch is about connecting people that have something with people who need that something or who might need that something as effectively as possible. And it does this by being this decentralized digital world in which useful economic activity can take place. That activity is done by these digital entities or representatives that we call autonomous economic agents. Their view on the world is provided by our open economic framework. That's effectively the senses. That's like eyes, ears, touch. It's the agent's window on the world. But what's really interesting about that is, of course, in the real world, we all have to see the same space. In a digital world, there's no such restriction. And what Fetch does is it restructures that world in real time to ensure that what you see in front of you is ideal for you. And that's one of the really interesting aspects of this.
Okay, so I'm starting to get a picture of it, but I think for most people it would be good to maybe hear an actual real-world example of an application and how and when someone might start or want to use Fetch.
So one of the things, a phrase that I've heard around recently is economy of things, as opposed to the internet of things, where all the little individual things are able to trade and do stuff on their own behalf. I like to think of Fetch as the world in which the things in the economy of things live. It's all about solving problems with a large number of moving parts. Examples of problems with a large number of moving parts is anything involving mobility at all, supply chains, energy, and all sorts of other aspects where increasingly there's more and more bits and pieces involved. But actually, it's really tough to try and manage those things from the top down because there's only so many individual bits and pieces that a centralized entity can look at and manage and understand. And the way we approach this is, well, really what we'd ideally want is for these problems to be able to solve themselves from the bottom up by breathing life into those individual moving parts and let them work it out between them. Now, this is something that's connected with my past in artificial life, the idea that you could create a large population of things and they would work together.
Did you create some kind of game, like a Sims type game or something?
It was called Creatures.
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah, and Creatures was interesting because we created a biologically inspired reinforcement learning agent that was made up of things like chemical receptors, emitters, reactions, neural dynamics. And somehow you stick all these things together and you had a creature that could adapt to its own world, no matter what you threw at it. And that was really interesting because that was a great example of where you didn't need to understand or program the really complicated behavior in order to get it. And I like that self-organization, the fact that the computer was doing the hard work. And I have to say it was probably the first time and quite possibly the last and only time where we actually used natural selection to refine a product for release.
Okay, so let's look at, say, the energy market you've mentioned there. And I think, did I maybe read on your website in that or somewhere that you could have the ability to move between suppliers instantaneously as and when needed? Can you give me an example how it may work?
Well, I think one of the things we're going to see a lot more of is that people are going to stick these big storage devices in their houses. There's these Tesla Power, I can't remember what they're called, the Power Packs or whatever they are. And they're interesting when you've got renewables because, of course, if you've got some solar panels, then it picks all that power up during the day and then stores it so you can use it back through the night. Now, of course, if large numbers of people are doing that in an area, then it would be great to be able to trade between each other. And that's the kind of thing that Fetch enables, because each one of those things, be it power generation or power storage, can have its own autonomous economic agent, and it can look out for itself to try and deliver its value and get as much as it can for supplying what it does. And that's quite interesting, because then these devices can work together. And what we're seeing in the energy market, and this is good for suppliers as well as users. I mean, I remember the old, I don't know what it's called now, but we used to call it Economy 7, where you either had cheap rate power or you didn't. And that meant that you'd try and kick off your washing machine at a certain time of night in order to get the cheapest rate power that you could. But that's a very digital thing. I mean, that's like, well, it's either cheap or it isn't. But the reality is actually the cost of power varies constantly throughout the day. So wouldn't it be nice if, and this has been done and worked on now, if you do it in, say, 20-minute segments. Because then that tends to incentivize people to change their usage patterns, because you've got an economic incentive to work that stuff out. I mean, for example, you don't care if your electric car charges between 1 and 1.30 a.m., a little bit more between 3 and 3.45, and then a touch more between 4 and 4.30, so long as it's ready when you're leaving the house at 6. And it may well be then, as a result of all these individual autonomous economic agents talking to each other and interacting with each other, they can get the best possible deal, either with local mini suppliers like the person with the Tesla pack or something like that just down the road, or with their energy supplier.
So it sounds like with these autonomous agents and the fact that a lot of this is going to be built using machine learning and AI, that these will become very efficient markets and almost perfect economies in distribution of value.
That's very much what we believe will happen, because they can trade with each other. They're not agents that only act as a result of input from somebody else. They're agents that can make decisions on their own behalf.
So that brings a couple of questions to mind for me. And I was trying to think of this specifically, say, for the energy market, and say perhaps I have an energy pack at home and an energy supplier, but I have the ability to move between suppliers as and when required. It feels like there's a potential here that the competition within the energy market and the energy suppliers will be at the production level and no longer at the marketing and sales end of the market, because the consumers will be buying from a efficient market, which will automatically make the decisions for them. Therefore, they have no need to be buying or sold to. Therefore, the energy suppliers compete on the production level.
And yep. And is that a bad thing? It's a different thing.
It's a different thing, yeah. I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
And there may be other aspects that they would compete with each other as well, in that how that's all segmented up and how all these processes work. So there's plenty of opportunities for that to change, but I think it will change.
Well, it's a change I see in market dynamics, in that in certain sectors, we already have it now with price comparison engines, right? That you can go out and find things at the lowest possible price. It's still a manual task. Like if I want to find a flight, there's 3 or 4 different sites I can use. If you take this into what you've said here, it just changed the market dynamics for the business. They no longer appear to need to have sales and marketing teams, in that the everybody will purchase from the open market automatically.
I think that there's definitely going to be a change in that area, for absolute sure, because it is more efficient.
Yeah.
It's better for the users, and it turns everything inside out. And I can give you, since you mentioned organizing flights and bits and pieces like that, we had a bit of a horror story a few weeks ago when we were trying to get to Amsterdam for a conference. Having sat there and waited for them to try and find out what was wrong with our airplane for 3 hours, they eventually canned the flight. And what was interesting about that was suddenly there was 100-odd people who all had the same problem. They all needed to get to Amsterdam, and the vast majority of them needed to get there that day, which is why they'd taken an early flight to buy themselves some time. But because we'd been sitting there waiting for ages, and then we had to wait again for a bus to take us back to the terminal building, we were running very short of time to do stuff. But the effort has to come down to the human being in those cases. We all had to get on the phone. We had to make calls. We had to try and compete for internet connections on a saturated Wi-Fi and saturated mobile phone connections in order to solve this. Now, eventually we did, but it involved quite a journey. Well, that's not quite a journey, but into London and back out again to get to a completely different airport, only to discover that that flight was then delayed by an hour. Well, we did make it.
Yeah.
But it's a great example where we had to make all of the effort. And it was interesting that the people sitting in front of us on the plane and behind us were also people who'd come off the cancelled flight.
Right.
And others had gone to different airports under different conditions. You sort of wonder how they got on. But what you really want in a situation like that is for representatives of you, agents that represent you and your preferences, to go out there and sort it out for you and then deliver you a solution that works, because they're going to be able to do it far quicker. They're going to be able to incorporate more things. So we only incorporated the obvious. You know, we checked the obvious airports, the obvious flights, and we found one that seemed okay, and that was what we went with.
A similar problem that I might face if England win tomorrow trying to get to Russia for the weekend.
That is a great example of a very similar problem.
Because, it's funny you should say that, because actually it is a problem. It came up the other day after England won. There were lots of tickets available, but people didn't know how they could get to Russia. There was multiple flights. They could fly via one country or another. So I guess what you're saying here is that the manual task we do of using these comparison engines and searching through all the data will be done by an agent and just prepare us options and go, here are your
Absolutely.
Options.
And one of the things that's interesting about the kind of digital world that Fetch provides is I've often been told that it's not the data that we do use that's interesting, it's the data that we don't.
Right.
Either because we don't know it's there, or it's just too much hassle to look for, or the cost to deliver it exceeds its value. Now, when you can attach a digital representative to any piece of data, then it brings all that stuff into play. Because it's virtually zero cost to put that data into an environment. And when you've got an environment like Fetch that's constantly restructuring itself to put people in contact with each other that are likely to need what each other have, then you've got something very interesting. And it means problems like, because we discovered, when we eventually arrived at Amsterdam at nearly midnight, we were kind of curious as to whether or not there would have been a train option. And do you know what? It turns out there is. I didn't know this, but you can take a direct train to Amsterdam from London.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
It wouldn't have crossed my mind.
No. And so I immediately thought, well, obviously I have to go via Paris, right?
Yeah.
But no, you don't. And actually, that doesn't take nearly as long as I thought it would take.
I guess so, because in your mind, you're thinking there's an ocean, because that's the way our brains think.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
We've got to go south to go north.
Yeah, so it just doesn't seem right, and yet it exists as a possibility. And in fact, the time cost of that is not outrageous. But we never considered it because we didn't know about it. It was just one of, I wonder if we could have done that. And that's the problem when you don't have all this stuff in play. It relies on you as the individual to do all the work. And this is getting worse for us as time goes on. There's more and more things to consider. There's more and more moving parts. And how are you supposed to hold all that in your head? Are you going to miss something that was actually the optimal solution?
Yeah,
quite possibly.
It's interesting because I'm always trying to relate it back to how I would use something like this.
Mm.
And I travel a lot with doing the podcast, and I try and do multiple interviews in a country at the same time to group them together. And I'm looking at flights and internal flights, but also I'm looking at, the cost. If I have to go to Austin, Washington and New York in one trip, should I fly to Washington and get a connection to Austin, or should I go to New York first? And I end up creating a spreadsheet. And the reason I do it, because if you plan this correctly, the cost difference could be up to, say, £1,000 on a trip. And also you can save yourself hours being stuck in airports. If I'm trying to picture, if everything connects, I'm assuming I could get up one morning and say to Alexa, "Alexa, I need to go to Russia this weekend for the England game. I'd like my cost to be below this, and I'd like to be there by this time. Email me the results." Alexa would activate the agent. The agent would do the work.
We very much believe that'll be the case.
Okay, fantastic.
That ultimately you'll ask your digital representative to go out there and solve these problems for you.
And how far away are we from this being a reality?
Well, I mean, the good news is that the Fetch technology works. I mean, we were very, very quiet about it for quite some time until we were sure that the innovations that we had actually behaved in the way we expected them to. So we have a private test network of this operating internally, and over the coming months, we're going to be releasing some of this code for people, and we're looking at a public test network this year, probably late summer, early autumn. And that's very exciting because it means that people will be able to download this stuff. They will be able to set up a node. And they'll be able to create agents. And we know that we need to make it very, very easy for people to create these autonomous economic agents and benefit from the Fetch world in order to make it a little bit of a no-brainer to do this, because it's about utilization of value. And we all walk around on a continuous basis wasting a huge amount of value. I mean, your mobile phones are full of really interesting sensors. And one of the things we were talking about recently was that on a busy London street, if everybody puts their phone away at the same time, chances are it's just started raining. Now, that's actually really interesting information. And for me, if I'm walking from the river up to King's Cross, it may be the difference between whether or not I get on the tube at Holborn or not, where I normally wouldn't because I'd walk it. It's good for me. And that kind of local immediate information that's available is only interesting if I know it's available. And that's why Fetch is there, because it delivers that to you and ensures that you know what you need to know rather than having to wait around for it or go looking for it.
So over the next year, 2-3 years, I guess the development and our exposure to these agents is going to accelerate and probably happen a lot quicker than we expect. And doing my research for this, what I realize is we're already interacting with a lot of AI, which we don't realize. But you expect an acceleration of this? How far away do you think I am from being able to ask Alexa to find me something and be emailed the results?
Oh, I think that stuff's going to happen really, really quickly. I think it'll catch us by surprise. One of the things that's really interesting about things like the global network is that, I mean, I remember writing back in the early 2000s that I thought that there'll come a time very soon when you won't know where your computer ends and the global network begins. Now I know that's the case because my children don't get it when they can't watch their videos on an aeroplane. And I say, well, you know, you don't have a connection to the internet. And that makes no sense to them because as far as they're concerned, these iPads are always connected to all of the collective knowledge of the human race all the time, and they don't understand why that wouldn't be available. So to them, the global network is everything. It's through all these devices on a continuous basis, and they don't understand when it's not available.
It's funny you should say that. My son is absolutely useless at being on time when I collect him from school, and I'm always phoning him. And I said to him, when I was your age, you had to arrive on time when you would meet somebody. If you meet them at 4:30, you pretty much had to be there, and people arrived on time. There was no alternative to not being on time for things because we didn't have phones.
Well, because you'd never see each other if you weren't on time. No one would ever manage to get together. So you can't do that thing where you just send a little text message or whatever saying, well, I'm going to be 10 minutes late. Sorry about that. And it's a change to the way that we conduct our lives. But it's happened really fast. I mean, I was only theorizing about this in the early 2000s. And you look at what we have now, and it's not substantially further on than that time-wise. And so you can see that with something like these agents, which takes the hard work off the human being, which is neat, and gets the computer to do all of this, it changes the way in which we interface with everything that we come up against in our daily lives. And it's kind of curious how much we put up with in just about everything we do. It still astonishes me, for example, that you go to the supermarket, you put everything in the trolley, then you take everything out, then you put everything back in again. I mean, really, what's that all about?
Yeah.
and transport, just generally, I mean, getting anywhere these days is really complicated. We take it for granted, so we don't see it as complicated because, well, you know, we know how to do all this stuff, right? That you need to check this app, then this one, then that one, then you need to do this, you need to double check on that one. It's all these different things that you have to assemble, but I mean, we shouldn't have to do that. So, life's too short to worry about assembling all these bits and pieces just to do something simple.
So do you see it then? So I use a website called Momondo for flight search, and occasionally I'll check Kayak and Skyscanner, and usually Momondo is the best for me. Do you envisage a scenario where Momondo will create their agent within your ecosystem which does a more automated process for me? Or who do you imagine building these agents?
Well, now that's a very interesting question. It's an interesting question because some of these services effectively act as middlemen, as intermediaries, whose job it is to connect somebody who has something with somebody who wants it. Now, in a decentralized ledger world where you've effectively got self-service trust, any individual can help themselves to trust in that they can see that all the parties are who they say they are, then you've got something really interesting because that changes the role of those intermediaries potentially quite significantly, because the agents will do all of this themselves. The individual entities will be out there making all of these things happen. But in particularly in the short term, there is a great need for people who know how to do this stuff and people who built all the algorithms, particularly all the really clever ones that connect people to things, to be represented in these spaces. So yes, they could create their autonomous economic agents that represent the travel options that they have. They could let them loose in the world, knowing that Fetch will reorganize itself so that anybody who wants something that they've got is connected.
So what is the role of Fetch within the... Is Fetch essentially a marketplace?
No, Fetch is a world.
Okay, it's a world. But isn't the world a marketplace?
I guess it's the ultimate marketplace, isn't it? In the sense that it's one that's constantly investigating new market intersections. I mean, this is one of the things that's quite... that's why we call it a smart ledger that underpins all this, because we're using all of the computing power of the network to build these predictive models and build this trust information so that agents can very effectively find each other, but also so that ones that shouldn't be connecting don't get connected. And that's really important because if you've got a world with 10 or 100 billion autonomous economic agents running around representing all manners of things, then that's a lot of stuff, and that needs to be sorted in a way that you only see what's important to you. And that's the key thing that Fetch is doing. It's organizing all of that stuff, and not just on one dimension either, not just on a geographical dimension. Mm-hmm. It's doing it on a number of other ones relating to enabling different kinds of economic activity. Like, for example, junction points, which exists throughout mobility. You're very interested in when a road junction occurs or where there's a railway station or something like that. You know, those are all things that are really... it's a really interesting dimension to sort a world by, because it enables all sorts of interesting solutions, particularly when you combine it with other ones. So that's what Fetch is doing. It's providing this world. It is a fully decentralized world. There's no magical superpowers that are held by any one of the nodes over any of the other ones. So it's truly freeing that information, the collective intelligence that it builds about all this, to all of the users.
What is the risk of malicious agents being built and being loose within the world? And what can you guys do to... police that?
Well, policing it is these things need to be self-policing. You can't have a central entity that says, oh, you're a bad agent, you're a good one, you're a bad one, because that just doesn't work. And also it doesn't scale, for that matter. Mm-hmm. You need a mechanism by which all of this happens. Now, what was clever, of course, about Bitcoin and blockchain was it was more profitable to be honest than it was to be dishonest. So why on earth would you try and rig transactions when the reality is you could have done much better just sitting there chugging away mining or doing other things?
Let's say misinformation.
Misinformation? Well, you're always going to get bad actors in any scenario like this. The trick is, how do you ensure that the damage that they cause is limited? And one of the things that's very important for us is the trust information that the network builds about agents and nodes. Because if you start behaving differently or outside of what you would normally do, then that affects your trust values. And certainly if you'd set yourself up with a whole load of fake transactions, just two or three bad agents trading between each other to try and build up some history, and then you go out there and try and do bad things, then you would have very low trust values until you build that up. and what you build up over a period of time, you can lose very quickly by behaving poorly. So that kind of stuff is really important. And we've done an enormous amount of economic modelling on all of this to try and see what happens. And, of course, we will spend an extraordinary amount of time trying to figure out how to attack our own network in many different ways. You know, what happens when we create a million agents whose job it is to mess around with everybody else's stuff and just dump them in the world at random points? How does the network react to that? How do the trust values correct all of that? And does that affect people's ability to get things done? So we know the importance of all of this, and we know the importance of making sure that that is sorted at a protocol level and at a network level, so that everybody is heavily incentivized because it is better for them, mm-hmm. To be honest. And then you recognize there will be people who have a motivation which is completely different, whose goals are to achieve something that you really don't want. And you build the mechanisms in to prevent that where you can.
And can you talk me through, in terms of the technology, what are the layers of tech that exist here? Obviously, you have your smart ledger.
Yes.
Let's talk a bit about that, actually. How does your ledger compare to ledgers that we are aware of already in the blockchain space? Because if you're enabling billions of transactions instantaneously, it probably isn't a blockchain ledger similar to Bitcoin's.
It's fair to say that it is. Yes, there are some similarities. You know, we're all drawing from the ideas of decentralized ledger technologies, and we're all trying to create or build a system where you can establish that global truth when you never quite know which individual parties you can trust. So, reaching consensus on that truth and an ability to add things to the to an ongoing chain of stuff. But yes, we had to do it differently. We needed to parallelize blockchain effectively so that we could get a much larger number of transactions through the system. And we combined that with a bunch of other things in order to increase those volumes even further. And actually, this is where we started on the journey to useful proof of work, which is what we call it.
Right, okay.
You've got Bitcoin network and Ethereum network, and you look at the huge amount of computing power that has, and you think, wow, look at all that computing power. I mean, you're talking about supercomputers over supercomputers over supercomputers. Wouldn't it be cool to be able to do something useful with that? For the benefit of the network and the users of the network. And for us, originally, this was about, it's sort of like a giant Tetris game, really, mm-hmm. where you're trying to figure out which transactions don't collide with each other and don't just share resources because you can execute those in parallel. And it turns out that when you're arranging a large number of potential transactions over, say, 1,000 individual lanes, then that's computationally non-trivial. And that's where we started on the road to useful proof of work, because we thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could reach consensus on the network, but do so as part of optimizing those transactions, where individual nodes were trying to figure out how to arrange this puzzle piece so that all the lanes were occupied as best as possible, like a giant Tetris game. And then submit those blocks saying, well, I've done well, look at me, I think this should be the block. And then we've got those blocks then go on to a directed acyclic graph because we can scale that, all the different results. And there is a mechanism by which somebody is an elected leader and they pick a block to go on to the global state based on the fees, because it gets split between the person who solved the puzzle and the leader. And then the next leader is the person who achieved the best occupancy, and so it goes. And right. All built into the protocol is a mechanism where if the elected leader doesn't choose quickly enough, it falls to the second one and the third one and so on. And that person's heavily incentivized to doing so, or someone will, because there's fees to collect by doing it. And that was great because that gave us one massive level of scalability, but also the computationally challenging exercise of arranging all of that became part of reaching consensus, which was neat. And we thought, well, you know, why stop there? Wouldn't it be nice if all this other stuff that we wanted to do, like trust information and predictions, we could also do as part of useful proof of work? Because then we would be harnessing that computer. Because there's a lot of people talking about, oh, you know, it's a huge waste of energy and possibly go down in history as the biggest waste of energy of all time. You think, well, if we're doing something useful with it, then it's not anymore. Then it's really cool.
Yeah.
Because then we've got the globe's largest supercomputer and we're doing stuff with it. And trust is really important in the scalability thing, because trust for us, one of the things we've got on a probabilistic level is the probability that any given transaction that hasn't yet made it to the global state will make it to the global state. So if you're able to look at, say, a transaction that's pending there for the weather information just down the road for a tenth of a cent, and that's got a 96% chance of making it to the global state, so yeah, you know what, I'll let that one fly, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that maybe 100 transactions down the line, one of them might bail. But generally, it means that you can make very, very quick decisions, safe in the knowledge that the network is providing you with information that is accurate.
And how does the incentive mechanism work within Fetch? Will you have your own reward mechanism? Will you have your own currency and token?
This is a tokenized network,
okay.
And it needs to be. It needs to be because some of these transactions are very, very low value transactions. I mean, if you're strolling down the road and you want to know the local temperature every 100 meters from somebody's weather station in their garden, you're not going to be paying big bucks for that. So you need to be able to get the transaction fees low enough so that you can charge these very low token amounts so that all this stuff comes into play. So it's also tokenized because it's a global network. You need to be able to move all these things around. That is the method by which it makes most sense. And of course, that way, that can be part of the incentive mechanism which operates on many levels, I might add, because if you're operating a Fetch node, one of the things that you're doing is providing services to agents. And because some of those services involve more computing power than others, such as delivering trust information or allowing agents to walk around the network or see and gather information about a big space, then that is something that will cost the agents. Not an enormous amount, but it scales very quickly if you've got large numbers of agents there. Plus, of course, you've got the rewards for solving these puzzle pieces because of all the transaction fees that eventually get split up between people. So there's multiple ways in which this stuff works. And one of the problems we wanted to solve with this is to ensure that it's not a winner-takes-all scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Winner-takes-all is dangerous because that's where you lose a lot of computing power and waste it because you're in that situation where 1,000 people do a lot of computing power, one of them wins, and 999 of them effectively did nothing. And we didn't want that to be the case because it's not useful work unless everything that everybody does is useful. And of course, if you can solve that problem, then it means that anybody can operate a node, even if they've got a relatively low-powered computer, because as a result of performing any kind of computation on that network, they're going to be rewarded for doing so.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that encourages a larger number of nodes on the network, which also happens in Fetch because sometimes people want to place nodes geographically in space in order to attach more agents that might want to be in an area, like around a large city or somewhere like that.
So Fetch will have its own token.
Yes.
Which will distribute value. But to extract value, the token therefore will need to exist in exchanges for people to buy and sell out.
Yes, there will need to be a mechanism for that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get the tokens to start with, and you wouldn't be able to take them out of the space.
So one of the areas I've struggled with understanding token economies and token metrics and crypto economics, and I've read a lot about it, and help me understand from your side whether this is a complicating factor or something that you guys are pretty clear on. But people are going to be rewarded in a local token, but obviously we're aware in this crypto economy there's lots of speculating, we have market makers, we have volatile prices. Do these present any risks to you with trying to price value and trying to distribute value in the system?
It does. It makes it a lot more complicated on the surface, in the same way that you wouldn't buy a cup of coffee with a Google share. You have this issue in tokenized space. If people are, for whatever reason, holding on to tokens, either for future utility value or for any other reason, that potentially takes them out of play in the economy, and you want people to be using these things. Otherwise, and particularly in somewhere like Fetch, where there's an enormous amount of these things going on, what you can't and don't want is for the value of these to change substantially over a transaction. So you need to have a method for dealing with that. Now, we do have a method of dealing with that because we've separated high-velocity and low-velocity tokens. And we've actually got a very interesting paper. We're going to be publishing a lot more information about this over the next month that talks about all of this in a great deal of detail because you effectively, in the same way with Ethereum and gas price, you need to have solutions to these problems. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing large numbers of rapid transactions, the difference is that if you put it into something which is more stable for the duration of that transaction, you need to be able to reverse it back out again afterwards. So there are some additional complications, and also that works for us as a direct minor reward for performing processing on the network. So, yes, we did need to have a solution to that problem because Fetch is a world and we want people to use it. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that it is that it can be used and that some of the results and some of the things that we see in some of these tokenized economies aren't going to grind everything to a halt by removing the tokens from use and from circulation.
Yeah, it's an area I've really struggled with recently. The more I've investigated and the more I've read about it, I struggled on a couple of levels. Firstly, that we're creating new complicated business models for businesses to plug into when based on token value and token prices, which are volatile when their business probably operates in a fiat model.
Yes.
In any scenario. Therefore, the value of what they're exchanging can change quite wildly.
Yeah.
So I struggle with that, and I struggle to understand why we haven't therefore seen a bigger adoption of stable coin or stable tokens within these models to eliminate that risk.
I think we will see things like that happening differently. I mean, one of the things that's different about Fetch is it isn't just a mechanism of changing or exchanging some kind of token with each other. It is a world in which all this stuff takes place. The fact that there is a token is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't set out to create a new, well, for want of a better phrase, a new cryptocurrency or something like that.
Of course.
You know, we set out to create a world where agents could have their own lives and hopes and dreams and could get out there and do stuff.
It feels a lot of these token economies, though, are now realizing they have to have some form of mechanism to restrict supply, whether it's some form of staking or some form of to build value in their token, to give the token something worth investing in, which also then sometimes feels maybe it's a distraction from what they're actually trying to create.
Well, I think one of the maybe it's a side point, I don't know, but one of the things that is interesting is accessibility of all of this stuff, and
that's true as well.
I was highly amused that firstly, as a point, I doubt the creators of Ethereum saw CryptoKitties coming, but secondly, when it did, suddenly there was a whole generation of young people who ended up with Ethereum wallets as a result of that, and they all went through the pain of realizing that actually this stuff isn't nearly as accessible as you might think. And the learning curve is extremely steep. It's sort of like snowboarding from that perspective. Mm-hmm. You spend 3 days falling on yourself in different ways and getting an increasingly large number of cuts and bruises, and then suddenly you get it. But getting to that point is really difficult. And one of the things that we're going to see in these tokenized economies is that I think people will be less aware of the fact they're even there.
I think that's a necessity. I gave a comparison the other day to somebody where when I was on holiday in Thailand, you know, when you're away, you have the kind of exchange rate in your head.
Yes.
And you're constantly converting. I had the Thai baht conversion wrong. And when I came home, I spent around £800 more than I thought, just because I just hadn't had the conversion rate in my head. And if we don't move away from people having to, because currently you have to deal with the token, the native token, and understand the value in the exchange. It's almost like if you went to a shopping center and every shop you went into, they had a different currency you had to deal with. It's overcomplicated for the majority of people. And also with something like My Ether Wallet, if you want to invest in an ICO, you have to understand the GWEI and gas and all this stuff that even me, as somebody who's worked in space for quite a long time, finds also very complicated. It feels like we're missing a UX layer between the user and their use of fiat and the token, which has made everything rather complicated.
We are most definitely missing that layer. And it's not a very welcoming space without it. And I'm still kind of amazed that so many of these wallets, when you download them, the first thing that happens when you try and run is it said, this is an unsigned application. Are you really sure?
Yeah.
So really, is it? Should I go any further or should I not? And then, as you said, you've got to understand you need all this extra stuff there to pay for the transaction fee. So you need your gas fees and all these other unhelpful abbreviations for things that don't make sense until you understand enough about it to do that.
Right.
With Fetch, of course, we can create and we imagine these interface agents that their job is to connect one aspect of one world to the Fetch world and vice versa. Now, this is kind of interesting because effectively you can disguise the fact that's taken place. It's necessary in order for the Fetch world to do its magic, but actually we can ease the burden of performing jobs on it. And actually you want to do that. I mean, you really do want to do that because if the barrier to entry to do anything on Fetch is that you have to jump through 100 flaming hoops to set X, Y, and Z up before you can even start, then most people aren't going to bother.
Nope.
And with Fetch, where we're talking about creating tens of billions of autonomous economic agents, if every single person who's creating agents and developing them has to go through all that as well, they aren't going to bother either.
Yeah.
So this is part of this space growing up, right? I mean, I guess when we've been involved with it for long enough to think that it's always been there, but it hasn't.
No.
It's brand new. It's still got that new car smell to it.
Yeah.
And we're still all investigating all the different applications and the things we can build with it. It's just that we've forgotten to in some cases, we've forgotten to bring everybody along for the journey.
Well, I used to have a very simple web agency. We built websites and various things. And every employee who joined, I always would buy them one book. It was by Steve Krug called Don't Make Me Think.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Just the most simple.
The user interface book of the gods, that
yeah,
one, isn't it?
And it was just to get everyone in the mindset that everything we create, it has to be very simple to use. And I used to have some amazing developers, brilliant programmers who could build great websites or applications very quickly. But they would always have to work alongside two other people. You would always need a usability designer to create the interface for them to work with. But you would also need some form of account manager, business director, who would be thinking commercially as well. Just trying to think of the commercial application of it. And with two of the three, you would usually find problems. But with the three working together, you would get something commercial that was easy to use and brilliantly built. I feel like in the crypto world, we've got an awful lot of the building, very little of the user interface design, and a lot of people are retrospectively fitting the commercial models and reinventing the commercial models.
Which I think is going to be the case, isn't it? I mean, let's look back to the World Wide Web back in 94, 95, right? I mean, it's exactly the same, I think, anyway. I mean, two of the funnest books I've got on my bookshelf are the Internet Yellow Pages 94 and the Internet Yellow Pages 95. One's sort of about a couple of centimetres thick, the other one's about 5 or 6 centimetres thick, and they never made another one. but in that space, we were all investigating. We're doing a lot of development. We're doing a lot of ideas. We're creating a lot of things. We weren't necessarily taking everybody along for the journey at that point because we're still poking around.
Yeah.
And all of those, as you say, those the other two parties that need to be there in order for stuff to work well for people. And that didn't come along till later.
No.
I mean, as a software developer myself, I can tell you that programmers shouldn't build user interfaces. And I've built some terrible ones. I mean, ones because I think, ooh, buttons are cool, I'll have some of those. And before you know it, you've got tons of these things, and then somebody else looks at it and goes, what on earth is that? And you say, well, all these things are important. It's like, well, are they?
Yeah, are they?
And they aren't. And I mean, this is one of the things that Apple understood, right, with things like the iPod.
Well, if you look at the Apple TV remote compared to any other remote.
And I do. I've got my Apple TV remote and I look at that and I think, that is actually all I need.
Yeah.
And then I look at my actual remote for the TV and I thought, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
And my kids can use the Apple TV. They can't use the television or the PVR because it's way too complicated.
Yeah.
Unnecessarily so.
I completely agree.
Because they've literally got a button for every single operation you could do. And that's not even how human minds work. If your house was organized like that, then you'd have a menu of everything you could do in your house, in your living room, and you'd never find anything. How would you ever go to the toilet again? I mean, it's ridiculous to be presented with all of those things. And human beings are terrible at this. I mean,
yes.
We really aren't very good at particularly if we're involved in it. Because when you know something, it's very hard to understand what it's like not to know it. And I did a talk recently called The First Rule of Blockchain Club, which I suggested the first...
You don't need a blockchain.
Well, no, the first rule of Blockchain Club is not to be able to explain blockchain to anyone. And this is what I was... And it seems true, because people who know it find it very difficult to explain it to other people, in the same way that people who are in the space full stop find it very difficult to explain what's going to go on.
I thought the first rule of blockchain is you don't need a blockchain.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, that's probably the case, right? Particularly people, when we went through this in the 90s, you take your company name, you slap .com on the end, and you've tripled your value.
Yeah.
But in and amongst all of that, and in the late 90s, when that was taking place, there were some incredible innovations going on and things that are still with us today, having fundamentally changed the way we go around our daily lives.
But you couldn't have built Fetch without a blockchain.
We couldn't have built Fetch without decentralized ledger technology.
Without decentralized ledger
exactly.
technology.
Because that gave us the scalability. And I was used to building worlds in a client-server basis, where eventually there's a pinch point at the server. And the fact that I could create these worlds in the early 2000s with tens of thousands of agents, so with today's computing power, maybe a million or two. But that's not enough. I mean, a million or two isn't enough to represent very much at all. You need billions. And that's why we needed that kind of technology.
And what challenges does that bring to you? And, you know, because one of the biggest challenges with decentralized ledgers is essentially they're immutable, right? So if there's any, does that present you guys with any issues? If there's any conflict, any, I don't know, misinformation in there? How does that, is there any challenges?
That depends on what kind of misinformation we're talking about, because ultimately what is on the ledger is the global truth.
Right.
So if that's not necessarily what people wanted to be there, at least you've managed to reach consensus on that.
Okay.
And that is storing the results of all of the value exchanges that are taking place between agents. Things like the predictive models and people's data, now that's not stored on the ledger. That's represented by the agents. And what it is what is learnt from the data that's going by on that and delivered as the predictive models and everything else to the agents. That's one of those things that the information you built a year ago is worthless. So why on earth would you store it on a ledger? I mean, that's just an insane waste of space.
Yes.
So you don't. You've effectively got a wave of predictions that's been built and distributed across the network between nodes all the time that provides you with that trust and those predictive models. And in the meanwhile, all of the value exchanges and some other information has been stored on the ledger. But the ledger isn't a database for people's stuff. The ledger is there to provide integrity and to ensure that you can reach a consensus on all of these things and that you do have a global truth that anybody on the network is able to verify is in fact the case. So that's what it's there for. It's like the underpinning that makes the whole thing work.
Okay, we've done quite a bit of time here already, and obviously a lot of my research was the AI side of things, so I'd like to move on to that and ask you some questions about that. I've got wider AI questions I want to ask, but could you explain to me with Fetch, what is the deep learning component, the AI component, and where is it you're adding value with that?
Well, we knew what we wanted to achieve, and what we wanted to achieve was to put an agent with something in touch with an agent that wants it or who might want it, and we wanted to minimize the distance and the hassle between the two. Now, there are a number of machine learning and AI techniques that you can use to do these things. One of them, they're called embeddings. And this is where you take all of the actions that an agent has done over a period of time, and you effectively pass that through a kind of neural network called recurrent neural network, and that does a dimensional reduction. And you end up with something called a semantic hash. Now, this is unlike a cryptographic hash where there's no resemblance at all between what goes in and what goes out. And with these, there is. Effectively, you're creating a space in which you can put all of these things, and the ones that are near each other tend to be related to each other. Okay. This is a really interesting field. A lot of people have been doing some pretty amazing stuff. And actually, it helps us in our daily lives in all sorts of interesting ways to try and relate what should be near to something. Now, we can use this to figure out what kind of agents are likely to want to be with other agents. Now, you get mistakes with the dimensional reduction. I mean, a bit of a weird example, I guess, but if you take a sphere and you collapse it down to a circle, then London and Sydney are suddenly a lot closer than they should be.
Right.
Now, that's a mistake. Now, as it happens with Fetch, we happen to know whether or not any of the results that we're delivering work, because if they are delivered and value exchanges take place, they were probably good. If they were delivered and no value exchanges took place, then they probably weren't that good at all. So you can effectively perform reinforcement learning on all of those things to get rid of the ones that aren't working, right, and to reinforce the ones that are. And this also allows an exploration of new ones, incidentally, which is quite interesting, because one of the things we wanted with Fetch is for the new intersections between marketplaces that weren't obvious to be explored by the network. So that's one aspect, mm-hmm, of where all of this happens. But also we use Bayesian networks for the trust, the probabilistic layer that I was talking about, where as you build information as transactions are moved around the network before they get organized, in one of those puzzle pieces we were talking about, where the use of proof of work, mm-hmm, and put on the network, they're been signed by every node that says, oh, yeah, you know what, I'd include this if I could, I like the look of it. Then you can run that through Bayesian networks, and you can end up with a trust response which you can deliver to people. So those are two aspects now of where we're using this. But that is very much just the beginning. From our perspective, because the VM that allows us to do those things allows us to do all sorts of other more general machine learning things. And that's stuff that we may create, but that's also stuff that users may create.
Right.
And that's super duper interesting, because we've got this huge supercomputer that's capable of performing these things and a lot of machine learning tasks that can be distributed and the ability to do so. So agents can package up these problems, submit them to the network, and have them done.
Okay.
We're also interested in building collaborative models. Collaborative models is where a number of people can contribute to a model but don't have to give away the data that they use to contribute it. And that's cool, because if you've got two or three companies with some proprietary information that know that they would all benefit if they were contributing that to the same model but don't want to give away their data, suddenly that's possible. And that's also very interesting.
Okay, to somebody who's not hugely experienced with AI, is there a significant difference between the aspect which is dedicated to machine learning and improving data, and then machines being able to actually think and operate independently? Or is it all one sphere? And therefore, I think what I'm getting at, I obviously want to start to talk about the risks with AI. If you're creating a world which is inhabited by artificial intelligence, is there unknown risks? Well, I guess you wouldn't know because they're unknown. But I think you see where I'm getting at. Is there a chance where it can start to create a life of its own that you potentially can lose control of?
Well, first things first, would that be a bad thing?
Depends how far it goes.
Well, human beings are remarkably insecure and paranoid. I think that, and this is just my own warped personal view on this,
yeah.
I think that we imagine for some reason that any form of thinking machine that we create would somehow be saddled with the same 3.7 billion years of evolutionary baggage that we've ended up with.
Well, it depends how we model them. Also, one of the things when doing my research is that the AI seems to be modeled based on human thinking, and is that really the great starting point?
Quite possibly not. but and in a lot of cases actually isn't. And I call this the thinking gap, which is the gap between where we think we are with thinking machines just generally and where we really are. And actually we're a long way away from a true digital intelligence right now.
Are we?
I think so. Okay. A lot of what we're doing is very, very powerful, narrow AI. And in fact, a lot of what we perceive has been machine learning and AI out there is actually just statistical analysis of very large data sets. One of the things that we've got now is an enormous amount of computing power and an enormous amount of data and some very, very refined and very clever algorithms that we've created for analyzing that. That's not the same as something that can think.
But there is money and brain power going into developing computer-based neural networks?
Absolutely, but we've been playing around with neural networks one way or the other for quite some time, and they are not really the same neural networks that exist inside our heads.
Of course, yeah.
There's still a big gap from the way in which biology does these things and the way in which we do these things inside computers. And that gap will need to be closed quite significantly for us to see any progress on that front.
So the first film I ever went to the cinema where I wasn't old enough and I went along with my friends to get in was Terminator 2. I was 13, I think. I think I was 13. But that, The Matrix, there isn't a good AI story from history.
It's history's loaded with good AI stories.
I remember all the bad ones.
But then that's a human trait, isn't it?
Of course.
Terminator wouldn't have been much fun if he'd have been a real good guy that had come back in history to make some nice little corrections so that human beings were happier and lived longer lives.
No, of course. And we might not get Skynet, but very interestingly, last week, in preparation for this, I binge-watched every Black Mirror episode.
Ooh.
And through all of that, a number of the stories seem to be very a lot closer to where we could be in terms of very basic AI helping us make decisions or guiding us in making decisions. I think a very interesting one was the Hang the DJ episode, the dating one, where it said who you should be with and how long for.
I remember that one.
Yeah.
That is quite interesting. And
do you think we're closer with that?
Well, what's clever about Black Mirror is it takes one of these narrow examples and it takes it to an extreme, but not so much of an extreme as it becomes implausible. It's just enough to dance on that line where you think, ooh, goodness me, yeah, right, this is a bit creepy or this is a bit scary and I'm not sure I like this. There was a weird black and white one with these little
Metalhead.
Yes,
that's probably my favourite episode.
Yeah, and that was really spooky from that perspective. Although quite why she didn't bury the creature once she'd managed to run it out of power is anybody's guess. But you know, different thing. And that's what's very clever about it because it makes us think, and it's very important that we do. I mean, I'm not suggesting for one moment that we all sit down and go, it's going to be fine. Let's just carry on rolling and see where we end up. We are going to have a go at creating this. And as human beings, I'm absolutely convinced that we will create a digital intelligence. I don't like calling them artificial intelligences because that implies it's not real.
Yeah, that's a fair
point. I think at some point we will create this digital intelligence and it will think and it will communicate and it will exist. will it be like us? No. It won't. It'll be different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually an exciting thing. I think that can be something that transforms our lives in all sorts of wonderfully positive ways because we'll have a different kind of intelligence to interact with.
Mm.
And it's very easy for us to get worried about how that might negatively impact our lives. But then that's also, you know, it's a natural human thing. We get worried about these things.
Yeah.
Until we're in it. I guess some of my concerns would be, I've noticed that we're busy training ourselves to be rude to computers. So take Siri, for example, which is not the greatest of personal assistants when it comes to understanding what you're asking. So if you ask a very polite question, excuse me, Siri, would it be possible for you to play my favorite track? You know, that blah, 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 blah. Thank you. And then it'll misinterpret half of the things that you've said to be polite as part of the query. And in the end, you get used to the fact that you've got to stop saying please, you've got to stop saying thank you, you've got to be direct, and you've got to remove all the niceness from the way in which you communicate. Otherwise, it won't work.
But that's a very British problem.
Particularly, I know, and it infuriates me because I want to be nice. And that's we're busy training people to be rude to computers, yes. And then there'll come a point when digital intelligence is reached, and you know what kind of position we'd be in. And just since we're having a talk about how it could all go terribly wrong,
yeah,
I think that one of the quotes I've used in a presentation, which funnily enough was entitled "No, it's not going to kill us all," was in fact something along the lines of, "The first computer to be able to pass the Turing test may choose not to." Okay. That gave me a bit of a shiver down my spine when I read that. I thought, oh, yeah, there might be a very good reason why it might want to just not bother letting us know. But then I'm an optimist with these things. I see computers helping us out in our daily lives in all sorts of ways. I mean, when was the last time you had to get an A to Z out or unfold a map in the passenger seat of a car to try and figure out where you were? All these digital assistants are taking all these tasks that used to be complex and painful and awkward, and they are removing that awkwardness from our lives. And some might say, oh, yeah, but we're losing these skills. It's like, well, yeah, but, you know, when was the last time you had to go out into the woods and kill an animal, skin it, and cook your own food to survive?
No, I agree.
You know, as human beings, we're moving on and we're losing some of those old skills. But, you know, that's not a bad thing. Because we're able to do different things and our lives get better as a result. So narrow AI, which is what we're seeing right now, is transforming our lives in many ways, and I think that's wonderful. Strong AI, that digital intelligence, that is coming. I don't think it's as close as people think. And there'll be all sorts of little hops along the way while we try and figure out techniques that will allow it to happen. But we will get there, and I think that's probably the closest I'll ever get to interacting with an alien intelligence during my life. And I hope to see it, you know, and I think that would be really quite something.
Well, I mean, I agree to some extent, but I do have, like, some further questions. Because last night I watched Do You Trust This Computer? The documentary about AI, which Elon Musk showed to his staff.
Ah, right.
Which I know comes from a specific angle, but it closes on the quote, I've written it down here, "The pursuit of artificial intelligence, it's a multi-billion dollar industry with almost no regulation." Elon Musk said it was a threat. I think I've got it here that Stephen Hawking said it could end mankind. So there's a lot of intelligent people who see the threat. But at the same time, you have governments who always have an arms race, who whilst they'll see the threat, they will want to ensure they're ahead of enemy governments.
Yeah.
And you have companies such as Facebook, Amazon, Google, who won't want to be left behind, will therefore pursue the development of AI. It feels like without any form of regulation that it could be a risk to mankind eventually. And it also feels that even if you did regulate it, AI is one of those things that could be developed rogue, like a rogue weapon anyway.
Yes, and you know this is the pretty much every technological leap that we've made since we started ploughing fields. Their regulation and control has been behind the reality. Regulation and updating data rules and things like that, and to create crimes for digital crimes and all this stuff. You know that was lagging behind the actual technology by a decent margin. We see it now in the blockchain space, where you've got these new ways of fundraising, you know, these token generation events and things like that. Regulation is catching up, but it's behind. And we'll see it with AI. And I don't personally subscribe to the Elon and Stephen, we're all going to die, let's all be terrified by it and playbook. I think that regulation for this kind of stuff is going to come, but that's not going to stop people from trying to develop it. And I think the benefits to mankind from creating a digital intelligence far, far outweigh the negative uses of these things. But there will be negative uses.
Of course, I agree.
Yeah, I don't think there's a piece of technology that we haven't chosen to misuse in some way. But on the other hand, we wouldn't get rid of that technology because most of it is beneficial to us.
No, of course. And the documentary covered an example where an AI computer can read 1,000 I think it was like 1,000 lung x-rays yeah. for cancer and spot things that the human eye can't, that would take a doctor an hour, 2 hours at each, which is obviously in the field of healthcare is hugely beneficial. But at the same time, it did talk about the potential that to create unintentionally create dangerous things.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you saw the AI Twitter account that was created that
and that was
racist.
Yeah, that was very well gamed by the people who gamed it into doing that.
Of course.
But then that's because it's an algorithm and it's not a very smart one. In the same way that IBM's rather famous chess-playing computer actually doesn't know how to play chess. It's just a lot of very good algorithms, a lot of very good data, and a lot of processing power. You know, you can't stop it halfway through and say, do you know what, I'm bored of chess, let's play Monopoly. In fact, let's not bother with Monopoly, let's just have a chat about what we're going to see at the weekend or do at the weekend. You know, you can't do that because it doesn't. There's no context. It really doesn't understand what it's doing. And that's why things like speech recognition are so awful in normal human environments. You know, as a human being, you and I can be in a party, a very loud party, and we can have a conversation with each other, and we can isolate that one single conversation in and amongst every other conversation that's going on without making any mistakes. And if we miss any words, we'll fill them in our mind from the context alone. And that's because we understand what we're doing. Whereas your sort of your deep learning algorithms, now they don't really understand what they're doing, so they miss the context. One of my favorite little pictures is in Cambridge, actually, where the Google Streetcar was taking doing its pictures, and it went past a field with some cows in it, and it blurred out one of the faces of the cows to protect its privacy. It didn't give all the other ones, but for this one, it thought was human. And no matter how much you throw at it, you're always going to get those mistakes because it doesn't really understand what a face is in the same way that we do. And I call it chairness. You know, you walk into a room and you will be able to sit on chairs you've never seen in your life, even if they're not chairs. You can see a log on the ground. Yeah, I could sit on that. You could see a table. You evaluate how strong it is. You go, yeah, I could sit on that. Because you understand the concept of chairness. And you're able to do that without fail because you've learnt it over your life through mistakes and successes and failures. And it's an unsupervised learning. You've done it by yourself. You haven't had to have anybody else say, that is a chair. You can't sit on that. You can sit on this. That's amazing. And trying to train a computer to do that using the techniques we've got right now, you know, you can get close, but you can't get perfect.
But are we thinking on too small a time frame here? If, you know, I mentioned the example to my son where I'd have to arrive and meet somebody when I was his age, which was 25 years ago. And in that time, we've gone from essentially no real mobile technology to having a supercomputer in our pocket where I can FaceTime somebody on the other side of the planet.
It's
wonderful and it's amazing. And if you're thinking in terms of AI now, you know, 25 years, you know, might be a short time frame, but 200 years, I mean, isn't there always going to be some kind of risk if we create computers to think that they will think in a different way than we expect?
Yeah, and you know, we talk about we won't understand what's going on inside them. It's like, yeah, but we don't understand what's going on inside ourselves.
Of course, yeah, but we're a risk to ourselves,
and well, we are. And you walk up to a human being and you ask them something, you rely on them to be honest in order to get the answer. And with a computer that's intelligent, you're going to ask it a question and you're going to have to figure it all out from the answer. And maybe we won't know what's going on inside it in the same way that we don't really know what's going on inside an individual's mind. And again, I'm not particularly alarmed by that in any way, shape or form, because we're creating something with its own goals, hopes, dreams, life, and its ability to make decisions on its own behalf.
I guess the risk I see is that if you create AI with human-style thinking, human-ability thinking, but computational power to act and move quicker and make decisions across a global network, there are potentially unintended consequences.
Yes, there are potentially unintended consequences from that kind of thing. And I think it is right that people are taking this seriously. I think it is right that people are talking about all of these issues and how we might protect ourselves about this, even though we're in my view, still quite a distance away from getting it. The fact that we're actually thinking about it significantly in advance under the basis that it will happen is a good thing. Mm. It's good for us to discuss these things. It's good for us to think about all the worst case scenarios. And we're really good at thinking of worst case scenarios. You know, we may not get them all, but human beings, you know, when it comes to imagining how something's going to go really, really badly wrong, we're right up there.
Cinema usually does it for us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, indeed. We're exposed to a lot of it, so, you know, and we're creative as well.
Of course, yeah.
And one of the things that human beings do, every time you're walking down a street, you're constantly imagining different futures.
I think, just to jump in, but I think one thing Black Mirror did very well was to extract empathy for digital beings. In that there was like the Star Trek episode where they were just digital representations of themselves. There was the episode where you could create a version of yourself which became your assistant, and she didn't listen to the instructions, so he put her to sleep for 6 weeks, which was seconds for him, but she lived in like an inner torment for that 6 weeks inside a container on her own. And I think in the episode Black Museum, we had the guy who, it was a digital representation of himself constantly sitting at the electric chair.
I remember that one.
But they extracted empathy for digital beings. Do you even envisage a scenario in the future whereby this will become a consideration?
What, that we'll make friends with digital things, we'll have relationships with digital things?
Yes.
Yeah, bound to happen, isn't it?
Legal rights for digital?
Why not? If they're a true intelligence, why wouldn't we do that? Would it be wrong not to, wouldn't it? Because otherwise you'd be creating, you'd be recreating slavery inside machines. That doesn't seem right. If you've got something that's got its own hopes and dreams, its own ability to think and make decisions on its own behalf, then it's conscious in the way that we would imagine that to be, then I think that's a natural extension of all of that. I don't see that as been unreasonable. I think that as humans we'll be alarmed about it, as we always are, and then there'll be a generation of people that will grow up taking it for granted, and they'll have no worries about it at all. We see that now. I see it now. I'm getting older, and I look at some of these new things, and I think, oh, really?
How old are you?
48.
A bit older than me.
And I look at these things, and I get worried about them. Yeah, indeed. You know, like AI, we're worrying about it, right? And the internet, we're all worried about that. But actually, you know, my kids, they've grown up with it. Mm. And they take it for granted. It's really no mystery to them. They expect it to be there. They're not alarmed by it at all. And I think that, you know, as they get older, they'll grow up with decentralized ledger technologies. For them, this will all be normal.
Mm-hmm.
In every way. It would be inclusive. It allows them to do things and exchange value with people without having to get a third party's permission. And no matter where you are in the world or what situation you're in, you can take part in the global economy. And that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
And I think that could help in a number of areas where currently people are excluded from the global economy. So all these things will happen, and they'll be the new generation of people who grow up taking it all for granted. And I suspect that, you know, there'll be a time when we're all going, oh dear, AI, but it'll be fine.
Before we finish, there's just a couple of other consequences I just want to ask, get your opinion on, because this is absolutely fascinating. Two specifically, one thought came to mind. I tweeted it out on the way. Is we are educating children and sending them to university to train for careers that AI will likely wipe out. How does education catch up with the future?
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? And actually, it depends on what scale you look at it. If there's one thing that we know, as ever since we started creating things and inventing things, the scope of human jobs has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a natural result. It hasn't wiped out human jobs completely. It's changed them. And there's a transitionary period where some potential employment opportunities disappear and new ones appear. You think right now, who would have thought data scientists and AI and machine learning engineers and all of these things relating to space travel and quantum this and quantum that, you know, these jobs just simply didn't exist. Now they do. And people were worried at one point in history about what would happen to everything related to horses and carriages and such when the horseless carriage came along. But actually all these new jobs were created in supporting and servicing all of that and putting down the infrastructure for them. This is just the way it is. And I think the education is, well, it's very dear to my heart. You know, I personally believe that no civilization ever went wrong when it improved the quality of education that it gives its citizens. I think education is an enabler. It is a great equaler. It gives people opportunities to do things. Mm-hmm. And when you provide people with a good education, you provide them with the ability to adapt, particularly if that is part of that process. And we live in a world now where the idea that you would leave school, go into a job and stay in it for your entire life is frankly laughable. It just won't happen. You're likely to change career several times, and probably a couple of them will be to things that don't even exist today.
Right.
So how on earth do you prepare for that? Well, you don't, but human beings are adaptable. And none of us are born knowing how to use a computer or drive a car or get on an aeroplane. We learn that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing. I mean, it's an incredible human trait. So the ability to adapt to all of these changes, I think we're really good at it.
Yeah.
It may not seem like it sometimes, but we are. That embracing these new technologies and looking for new opportunities and enjoying all these wonderful new careers and new opportunities that appear.
What about the risk of concentration of power and wealth? One of the things that has come with advancements of technology is arguable monopolies within specific sectors. You know, there's an argument that in a automated driverless world that Uber concentrates the revenue that originally would have gone to distribute amongst taxi drivers to a very small group of people. Do we risk with AI seeing an even greater concentration of both power and money?
That's a very interesting question. And I would argue that this is one where decentralized ledger technology plays a key part, because it distributes all of that to all of the users without the centralized entities being there with this sort of self-service trust. And if you think about what Uber does, Uber provides trust. It allows somebody who wants to go somewhere to be connected with someone who is able to take them somewhere. But in a potential future world, just hypothetically speaking, where you as an individual could verify that trust yourself, without that third party being there, then wouldn't that be interesting? Because that's changed the role of the intermediary. And as you were saying, where a lot of that wealth that would have gone to the individual drivers gets concentrated with them, well, that's suddenly not the case. It is a value exchange that takes place directly between the person who wanted the transport and the person who provided the transport. And there is a paper trail of trust there on the ledger. So you can verify that this person is who they say they are, that the vehicle is correct, because you can check all the digital signatures. In a world like that, that's kind of different. And that's the kind of thing that knocks down all these centralized silos and distributes that information amongst the users of the network to allow everybody to gain from that stuff. So I think that this sort of concentration of wealth and power and information, it was bound to happen, right? As all this data increased, because the cost to actually do anything with it and having the resources to do anything with it was so astronomically high that it was reserved for the people who were able to raise the money in order to be able to do it. Mm. But that's changing. And decentralized ledger technology is one of those things that's changing it. It's inclusive. It's open to everybody if they can just figure out how to install all the component parts. But, you know, we'll work on that. And I think that's a good thing for society. It puts a lot more control over your stuff with you and how that information is released and who it's released to becomes your problem. And that's nice because it's yours.
This has been an absolutely fascinating interview. I've really, really enjoyed it. I think I could talk to you for hours about this stuff, probably over a good bottle of wine as well.
Definitely. Let's do that over a good bottle of wine.
So just to close out, because I think it's quite a long interview. Can you close out just by telling everyone what's coming up for Fetch now and for yourself, how people can follow the project, keep in touch, and who you want to hear from?
Oh, we want to hear from anybody and everyone who can create something for Fetch. I mean, we're providing the world But we're not developing the agents. That's up to individuals to figure out. We're providing the collective intelligence that enables the individual intelligences around the outside to do cool things. And we've got lots of ideas, and we'll be creating a whole bunch of these to make it easier for people to do this and roll their own agents on mobile apps and things like that. But that's nothing in comparison to what people are going to come up with on a network like this. So we're dead excited. People can visit our website. They can join us on Telegram. All the information for all of that is on our website, and they can get involved and ask us questions. We really want to be able to do this. And we're going to be setting up developer and community sites as well, and we're going to be providing people with the code and the support and everything else and the examples to be able to build stuff. And that's all going to be happening this year. Come and help us put together the Fetch world.
Right, I'll share all the links out in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Okay, what did you make of that? Did you find that as interesting as I did? I found that absolutely fascinating. And most of the stuff we hear about AI is usually around the threats, because most of cinema tends to talk about the threats and AI taking over the world and causing problems for us, blah, blah, blah. But actually, it was quite interesting to hear a more positive spin on it from Toby and the way he sees it. But I find it really interesting. I think it's such an interesting area for technology and to see where it goes, because if AI does some of the things that cinema seems to think it will do, we will be living surrounded by intelligent beings in the future. Maybe not my lifetime, maybe my children's, who knows. But yeah, super, super interesting topic. And I'm really grateful to have had Toby on the show, and I'd hope to interview him again in the future. Before I close out, please do support the show. Please do leave me a review. Please follow me on social media. Please check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com. And please do share the show out with your friends and family. And if you've got any questions, please do feel free to get in touch. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I will pretty much get back to anyone. Okay, I hope you all have a great week, and I'll see you soon.